Okay, well, we are still in 1 Samuel, and we are still with the United Kingdom. The United Kingdom is a little bigger than I thought and covers a little bit more, and I think there's some good details. Hopefully, we'll get into the divided kingdom. I think I have two more weekends after this, and I think Dwayne takes over in the middle of October. We're nearing the end of this study, maybe 3 more weeks total, including this one. And then it looks like I'm basically halfway through what I thought I would be doing as far as this whole study. We had left off in 1 Samuel, and we were about in chapter 14, 15 is where we ended up the other night. We had talked about how Saul was rejected by the Lord as king, and again, his refusal by Israel, I guess, to fully complete the commandments of the Lord. And we had talked a little bit about that, and that Saul chasing after David through the next few chapters, and that really takes up quite a few chapters there. This is where I wanted to begin our study of David. In 1 Samuel chapter 16 is where that really starts. And I thought there's an important verse here that we should read. So we're in 1 Samuel chapter 16 and verse 7. But the Lord said to Samuel, "Do not look at his appearance or at the height of his stature, because I have refused him. For the Lord does not see as man sees, for man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart." And therein lies the major difference, really, between us and the Lord. We tend to look at outward appearance, which is what we can see, and the Lord does something quite different, and that is looks at the heart and looks inward. So, what an important thing for us to remember is that the Lord is looking at our hearts, knows our hearts, and knows our intentions. So, very important verse there. It kind of sets the stage for why David was so loved, and also a good and important thing, a reminder for us to remember. So what exactly was God looking for in the heart of David? Well, if you go to 1 Samuel chapter 13, you backtrack, 13:14, it says, "But now your kingdom shall continue. The Lord has sought for himself a man after his own heart, and the Lord has commanded him to be commander over his people, because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you." So here we have him, you know, spelling it out that he's looking for a man after his own heart, and that that at this point has not been there. Chapter 17 is a great chapter and a great story, one that we're all very familiar with David and Goliath, and we could spend at least a class on that. But I think because we know it so well, I just wanted to look at a few things here. You know, were the Israelites supportive of David's idea here? You look in chapter 17, verse 28. We know his brothers weren't. It says, "Now Eliab, his oldest brother, heard when he spoke to the men, and Eliab's anger was aroused against David, and he said, 'Why did you come down here? And with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your pride and the insolence of your heart, for you have come down to see the battle.'" So he really gets on to him here. Of course, David was a son of who? Jesse. And how many sons did Jesse have? I had to go back and read it. I forgot. 8. So there in verse 12 it says, "Now David was the son of that Ephrathite of Bethlehem, Judea, whose name was Jesse, who had 8 sons, and the man was old, advanced in years, and in the days of Saul." And then he goes on to tell about the 3 oldest sons. Let's see here. 3 sons who went to battle were Eliab, and then Abinadab, and then Shammah. And so, again, great story. One of the things that I had gone back through and kind of reminded myself of, matter of fact, I had some notes in my Bible about this, because I think we've all gone through this story, and it's just a good one. But you know, David ended up killing Goliath what with, ultimately? I mean, he hit him with the stone, but what did he end up killing him with? Yeah. So he killed him with his sword, with Goliath's sword, which is kind of an interesting thing. And really, what did Jesus do? There's kind of a similar theme there, I guess. What did Goliath, or what did Goliath, what did Jesus really kill off Satan with, in essence.
Cross.
What's that?
The cross.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So basically, you know, his own death and resurrection. And so kind of interesting, you know, to think about that a little bit. But there's some neat things there. There's a lot of details there. And I had gone back, and this was just some things I had looked at. Let me just go back and read in Hebrews. Let's see if I can find this real quick. I think it was in Hebrews. Sure. Yep, that's another. Yes. Hebrews. Hold on, let's see if I can find this here real quick. I think it was Hebrews 2:14 is where I was at this morning. Let me just look here. Maybe I can't find it, but inasmuch then as the children have partaken of flesh and blood, he himself likewise shared in the same, that through death he might destroy him who had the power of death, and that is the devil. Yeah, so, and that's where I was heading. But interesting. I don't know if anybody wants to point out anything there about the story. If our kids were upstairs, I'd definitely go through it in more detail. That's a great story for all of us, but I don't want to get bogged down, because like I say, I think we can spend a ton of time there. Okay, so we have chapters 18 through 24 really are about David and Jonathan. And there's some good things there. Saul spends a lot of his time and effort in pursuit of David to slay him. And, you know, the one thing we know and we read about there is that David spared Saul's life, you know, on multiple accounts. And so if we kind of fast forward, and if anybody had any points they want to make in those 5-6 chapters, please feel free. But in chapter 25, we get into David, Nabal, and Abigail. And at the first part of the chapter there, David sends word to Nabal, reminding him that he didn't bother his shears during shearing time. And he goes on to request some supplies, which is kind of interesting. Does anybody remember what happens after that?
Nabal says no way.
Yeah, yeah. Refuses. Takes pretty great offense, you know, pretty angry about that. And then if you skip down in that chapter 25 to verse 14, it says, "Now one of the young men told Abigail, Nabal's wife, saying, 'Look, David sent messengers from the wilderness to greet our masters,' and he reviled them." And then if you come on down by verse 18, it says, "Then Abigail made haste and took 200 loaves of bread, 2 skins of wine, 5 sheep already dressed, 5 seahs of roasted grain, 100 clusters of raisins, and 200 cakes of figs, and loaded them on a donkey." So, waste no time taking these supplies. And then, if you read in verse 19 and 20, there's a few verses I want to read just to capture this. And it says, "And she said to her servants, 'Go on before me, see I am coming after you.' But she did not tell her husband Nabal. So it was as she rode on the donkey that she went down under cover of the hill, and there were David and his men coming down toward her, and she met them." And then, we can read on 24 through 34, gets into the story, but we'll skip ahead. Verse 29 says, "Yet a man has risen to pursue you and seek your life, but the life of my Lord shall be bound in the bundle of the living with your Lord your God, and the lives of your enemies he shall sling out as from the pocket of a sling." I know I've read this story before and probably read through that and didn't really catch that, but reference here to the sling. And I should have backed up there in 28, but it says, "Please forgive the trespass of your maidservants, for the Lord will certainly make for my Lord an enduring house, because my Lord fights the battles of the Lord, and evil is not found in you throughout your days." And then skipping down in verse 34, it says, "For indeed, as the Lord God of Israel lives, who has kept me back from hurting you, unless you had hastened and come to meet me, surely by morning light, no males would have been left to Nabal." So here we have the reference of the good that, you know, she had come to save his lives. And then towards the end of the chapter, we know that Nabal hears of the events and really, I guess you could say, his heart fails him. And then 10 days later, we read how the Lord struck him dead. And David proposes to Abigail, and we later know she becomes his wife in addition to another wife that he had. What was her name? Okay. Maybe I wrote this down wrong. Did I have Ahinoam? Let me look here. Maybe I've got this wrong. Let's see. Okay. Yeah. Huh. I wonder if she was known by something. Why did I have that down? Well, yeah, I had two, but maybe he had more, and I had.
In 25 and verse 43, he's had several.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Well, that's where I had it. David also took Ahinoam of Jezreel. Yeah. So, like I say, there were multiple wives. So both of them were his wives, is what I was getting at there in verse 43. He talks about both of them. Now, maybe he had.
Well, mine was 44, but that's when he ended up, Saul took her away and gave her to somebody else.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. Which is interesting. I don't know what to really say about that other than he had the multiple wives. Interesting to know if that caused him grief. If we go on to, and I want to get into a little bit about David sparing Saul's life, and we can read a few of these events. Will somebody read in chapter 26, verses 9 and 10? Right, yeah. So, be interesting to go through and see how many we can count.
Come on.
Yes, 26, 9 and 10.
David said to Abishai, "Do not destroy him, for who can stretch out his hand against the Lord's anointed and be guiltless?" David said, "Furthermore, as the Lord lives, the Lord shall strike him, or his day shall come to die, or he shall go out to battle and perish."
Okay. And then I'll read 12 through 18, and I might have somebody in a minute read 21 through 25. But 12 through 18 says, "So David took the spear and the jug of water by Saul's head, and they got away. And no man saw it or knew it or awoke, for they were all asleep, because a deep sleep from the Lord had fallen on them. Then David went over to the other side and stood on top of a hill afar off, a great distance being between them. And David called out to the people and to Abner the son of Ner, saying, 'Do you not answer, Abner?' Then Abner answered and said, 'Who are you calling out to the king? Who are you calling out to the king?' So David said to Abner, 'Are you not a man? And who is like you in Israel? Why then have you not guarded your lord, the king? For one of the people came in to destroy your lord, the king. This thing that you have done is not good. As the Lord lives, you are not worthy to die, because you have not guarded your master, the Lord's anointed. And now see where the king's spear is, and the jug of water that was by his head.' Then Saul knew David's voice and said, 'Is that your voice, my son David?' And David said, 'It is my voice, my lord, O king.' And he said, 'Why does my lord thus pursue his servant? For what have I done, or what evil is in my hand?'" And then somebody skip on down while you read 21 through the end of the chapter, 21 through 25.
"And Saul said, 'I have sinned. Return, my son David, for I will harm you no more, because my life was precious in your eyes this day. And you have played the fool and erred exceedingly.' And David answered and said, 'Here is the king's spear. Let one of the young men come over and give it. May the Lord repay every man for his righteousness and his faithfulness. For the Lord delivered you into my hand today, but I would not stretch out my hand against the Lord's anointed. And indeed, as your life was valued much this day in my eyes, so let my life be valued much in the eyes of the Lord, and let him deliver me out of all tribulation.' And Saul said to David, 'May you be blessed, my son David. You shall both do great things and also still prevail.' So David went on his way, and Saul returned to his place."
Okay, thanks. So after all that, and Saul basically says, "Hey, I've sinned. I'm not going to harm you anymore." Does David believe that?
Read the next verse.
Yeah, exactly. That's where I was going. Chapter 27, verse 1. "And David said in his heart, 'Now I shall perish someday by the hand of Saul. There is nothing better for me than that I should speedily escape to the land of the Philistines, and Saul will despair of me to seek me any more in the part of Israel. So I shall escape out of his hand.'" So we know, that's why I asked that, that basically out of self-preservation, he says, "You know what? I've got to leave this Philistine land and move on." And then verse 4 says, And it was told Saul that David had fled to Gath, so he sought him no more. So he finds out that he's fled, and he says, I'm not gonna pursue him anymore. And then what do we see from David that was really different than anyone else? What was one thing that was lacking in the Israelites before that now David does differently? And you'd have to read through these stories to pick up on it, but what's the one thing they never really fully did? You know, the Lord had given them instructions to, when they went in and took over, clean them out, you know, do away with everyone. And they never really did. They either left a few, married a few, chased them out, said, oh, that's good, but they didn't really do away with them. And if you read down in, verses 10 through 12, then it says, then Achish would say, why have you made a raid today? Or where have you made a raid today? And David would say, against the southern area of Judah, or against the southern area of the Jerahmeelites, or against the southern area of the Kenites. David would have neither man nor woman alive. And this is the part I was getting to. David would have neither man nor woman alive to bring news to Gath, saying, lest they should inform on us, saying, thus David did, and so was his behavior all the time he dwelt in the country of the Philistines. So Achish believed David, saying, he has made his people, Israel, utterly abhor him, therefore he will be my servant forever. And I read too much there. But when you read his stories, you realize that David did exactly what was said. Man nor woman nor child, they utterly destroyed him. And that was different from some of the leaders that we had read before. Okay, so does anyone have any questions or comments about anything before we get into chapter 28? This has got an interesting story in here, and I don't know what to totally make of it, but I just thought we should hit it. And I know we're primarily studying about David, but I wanted to spend a few minutes looking at this witch of Endor, which is a medium that Saul had inquired of. In chapter 25, when Samuel died, and we skipped over this, and here in chapter 28, verse 3, we see that with Samuel dead, Saul had expelled the medium and the spiritists from the land. Except, and I think it's interesting, once Saul now saw the Philistines' army, he got really scared, and in verse 5, you know, he was really afraid there, and it says, when Saul saw the army of the Philistines, he was afraid, and his heart trembled greatly. He was extremely fearful. His heart trembled. Terror fell upon him. And so, what's he do? He inquires of God, but did God answer? He didn't. And so, immediately, you know, he panics, and he told an attendant to go find a woman who was a medium. And so let's just read verses 6 and 7. It says, and when Saul inquired of the Lord did not answer him, either by dreams or by Urim or by his prophets. Then Saul said to his servants, find me a woman who is a medium, that I may go to her and inquire of her. And his servants said to him, in fact, there is a woman who is a medium at Endor. So I said the witch of Endor, but that's what we commonly think of. Is there a problem with him seeking out this medium? Yeah. Right. Okay. And why? I mean, why would... I know this may seem obvious, but I think we should talk about it. Well, I mean, why is it that we don't seek out these mediums or these...
The answers for us, and particularly this time, come from God.
Right.
You know, and even Samuel... or whatever this is that's talking to Saul, says the very same thing. Well, you didn't hear from God? Well, that's kind of an answer, isn't it?
Right. You know? Yeah. So do we need to seek out others' counsel or these witches, I guess, or these mediums for an answer? And the answer is no.
We're told in the New Testament that we have all things that pertain to life and God.
Yeah. Yeah. Good.
That's funny, that word. Medium is familiar spirits, what it's called.
Right. Yeah.
Old. Uh-huh. And that comes from a word which means a hollow sound. In other words, what they're saying doesn't mean anything.
Yeah. You might think you're hearing a voice, but it's clanging. It's nothing. Yeah. You know, we had read where Saul was impatient earlier, and that caused him grief. Remember, he didn't wait for Samuel, and we studied about that. But, you know, it used the term back there, if I remember right, in his own mind. And, you know, that was the issue, is that he was, you know, his first real test as a leader. And what's he do instead of resorting to what God had told him or what he knew he should do? He whatever he thought was right in his own mind is what he did. And that was the problem. So here we are, you know, we see this with Samuel. And instructions were to wait, and now we need to seek out a medium. So I think it's an interesting event here. Let's look at his response. There in chapter 28, verses 16 through 20, it says, "Then Samuel said, 'Why then do you ask me, seeing the Lord has departed from you and has become your enemy? And the Lord has done for himself as he spoke by me, for the Lord has torn the kingdom out of your hand and given it to your neighbor, namely David. Because you do not obey the voice of the Lord, nor execute his fierce wrath upon Amalek, therefore the Lord has done this thing to you this day. Moreover, the Lord will also deliver Israel with you into the hand of the Philistines, and tomorrow you and your sons will be with me. The Lord will also deliver the army of Israel into the hand of the Philistines.' Then immediately Saul fell full length on the ground and was dreadfully afraid because of the words of Samuel. And there was no strength in him, for he had eaten no food all day or all night." Whew, scary, sad deal. You know, he realizes what he's done, realizes what's going to happen, and he just falls to the ground and basically realizes that's the end.
Go back, and the familiar spirit was one that really was just saying empty words. That this one really brought up
exactly
Samuel. Well, yeah. God allowed Samuel to speak through her, or he spoke directly to Saul.
You get that feeling, yeah, That's the way I understand it. So there's a difference.
So it's, yeah,
God using someone to speak. That's right. That's right. Which is interesting, you know, is that different for us today? And I think, you know, I mean, clearly the answer would be yes, but we do have, and this is the tricky part, this is why I brought this up, but I mean, we know that we rely on each other to talk things out and bounce things off each other, and God doesn't do what he did in that time to speak, you know, through Matt to Dwayne, but we see that here. But that was different than this medium that he was calling out for. This witch of Endor.
It almost sounds like the woman had left while all this was going on.
Right, yeah. Because she was a little troubled and thought, whoa, wait a minute, what's going on here? This is more than my little fake thing that I usually do. Yeah, right. I mean, that's a good point, Theta.
Because since came back to Saul, so she must have left for a little while.
Yeah, I don't know.
You know,
she was severely troubled.
It's difficult for us to understand.
It is.
Because we get a picture in our mind that, you know, it's some hopes.
Yeah.
Because that's what we have. But there's something legitimate about this whole thing. And you know, Paul's gone to her in a disguise, and yet she recognizes, you know, had she ever met Saul? We don't know, but she recognizes that he's Saul. And, you know, we go to Simon the sorcerer, and there's something.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it appears as though what's going on in these people is not the same as what, you know, we see in the 1-800 numbers that, you know, are advertised late night on television, or issues. You know, it's different.
Ben, you're staying up too
much. There's something legitimate here. So,
well, but is it any more legit, though, than some of these people think they are today? Because they would tell you they're legit. I mean, that's what I struggle with, too. Is it any more legit than the people? Because I will tell you, I've got a person that goes to someone in Springfield and tries to get in touch with her ancestors. And she believes it. And you know the people that she's paying believe it. Well, I guess they do. But it makes you wonder, this lady here,
well, I think God allowed Satan to perform miracles during, you know, remember when Moses went to Pharaoh, and Moses performed miracles like he threw the rod down and turned into a snake.
Sure.
Well, Pharaoh's servants did the same thing.
Yeah.
But then Aaron's rod ate up their snake.
Yeah.
My point is that I think God allowed Satan to perform miracles for a time upon the earth. Is he now? I don't know. I don't think so, but he directly allowed him to by the hand of man before Christ. Look at what he did to Job.
Right. Sure. Well, and are there modern day angels of Satan today? Does he have?
I don't know if they were going to say this was definitely a supernatural.
Oh yeah, it was. Natural, yeah,
it
yeah.
was a spiritual, and like Mike said, the devil.
Oh yeah, sure.
So he had power. To
do yeah, yeah.
But I think that we are. But just to understand, that power has been taken. He's bound somehow now in that type of power.
Yeah.
But he still influences people in a natural way.
Yes, right.
He influences us very strongly.
Sure. Yeah, he has different tools today a little bit. Yeah. Good. Well, Ben, I didn't mean to cut you off. Did you? Sorry. It is interesting.
I don't know that we can have just a super clear answer.
I know.
It's just odd.
It is.
Everything is odd.
It's odd.
Is this Samuel? I guess it's Samuel. The Bible calls it Samuel.
Yeah, right.
He talks like he's Samuel.
Right.
It's like it's from God. It's just all of this is very strange.
Yeah.
And
well,
the words he said made sense.
Right. Well,
the reason they should have been said the song.
Right, right.
I just mentioned today also, I think there's a reason that it's very important for us to stay away from certain things. Very important to stay away from devil worship and other aspects. And there's a reason for that.
Right.
I don't know what power Satan has, but at the same time.
Well, what does it really do? I mean, is it what would be the benefit to it? And I think, to your point, I mean, there's just certain things we stay clear of as Christians. There's no, to Ben's point, we have everything we need. So.
I think there is a power there that can strongly influence what it is.
Yeah. Mike, what were you going to say?
But I was just going to say to allow Satan to have any influence in
right.
our life. I mean, like, of course, if we're
silly. Yeah.
Seeking something from Satan, I mean, what kind of insult is that to God? He threw him out of heaven.
Right. Yeah, what benefit is that? Yeah. But we know kids and they're inquisitive and they get into those things. And I say kids, I mean, I think that's where a lot of it starts, but it's something we have to be careful of. Good comments. Okay. So then we go into chapter 30, and we have God answering David here. But David had returned to Ziklag from Sanerite, and he finds that the Amalekites had attacked Ziklag, and they had burned it, ransacked it. And then they had taken his women captive and all who were in it, young and old, we see that. And then, let's read how David's men discovered this. There in verses 4 through 6, it says, "Then David and the people who were with him lifted up their voices and wept until they had no more power to weep. And David's two wives," again, interesting, his two wives. I need to go back, and we probably all need to do our homework on how many wives and why do we have...
He only has two wives right now.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, at what point do the others disappear, and where'd they go? And yeah, because he had more than two throughout time, right?
Right,
and
four for sure.
Right, yeah.
Well,
and did they die? Of course, we're getting ready to talk about here how... Yeah, go ahead, Ben, what were you going to say?
Well, I was just going to say, he only has two wives right now.
Yeah.
He should have three, but he's only got two because Michael, who should be his wife, was given away.
Right.
And then it's not until he becomes king that he gets additional wives. Actually, we know he had at least five because when he was old, the
Shunammite, yeah, I think.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah, so an interesting side study for us to read. Okay, so 4 through 6, all right, verse 5. And David's two wives, Ahinoam and the Jezreelites, and Abigail, the widow of Nabal, the Carmelite, had been taken captive. Then David was greatly distressed, for the people spoke of stoning him, because the soul of the people was grieved, every man for his sons and his daughters. But David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. Then David said to Abiathar, the priest Ahimelech's son, please bring the ephod here to me. And Abiathar brought the ephod to David. And I read an extra verse there, but we're going to get into that anyway. So David found strength in the Lord, it says. And then David goes to the priest Abiathar and requests this ephod. Now, what was he actually doing by requesting this ephod? What was this ephod going to do? Okay, kind of a sign of his guidance, looking for his wisdom and guidance. And then what do we know about the Urim and Thummim? Am I saying that right? Thummim? What was that? Does anybody remember?
Kind of a yes and no computer type
thing. Okay, all right. That might be one way of saying it. Has somebody over here had a comment? No.
One of them represented lights.
Okay. Well, and I don't either, but I came across that. And then you read other places, and it talks about curses and perfections. And so they're in, let me go back. I think it's 28 and 30. No, that's not it. Oh, yeah, Exodus. Sorry. If we go back, and we had gone through this once before, but as you can see, I can't remember it all. But 28 and 30 says, and you shall put in the breastplate of judgment the Urim and the Thummim, and they shall be over Aaron's heart when he goes in before the Lord. So Aaron shall bear the judgment of the children of Israel over his heart before the Lord continually. So this Urim and Thummim should, you know, I guess is a sign, basically. I mean, it really does, but so it goes over his heart, and
the ephod, it was a type of a clothing.
Yeah, like a vest.
Clothes, but, you know, some kind of a vest or garment that the priest put on to communicate with God, I think. And this Urim and Thummim was part of it. At least at times. And didn't they wear that when they consulted with God?
Yeah, that's my understanding, is that they would put that on.
Wasn't there also 12 stones in that?
Yeah.
Seems like I remember that. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So it kind of a unique item. And really, when you think about that, that's a whole other unique thing that they would put on this, and it had meaning to them, obviously. But so, you know, there in Exodus chapter 28, the reason I read that is that's kind of where it's introduced to us. And then, you know, we studied in that chapter, that's where the priestly garments, specifically the ephod and this breast piece, as it reads there. So, I don't know. It's just something to think about there. So, these were used, Dwayne says, the computer system of yes and no's. I had to shake out to either get a yes or no. I mean, the answer, that's what it was. They wanted to get a yes or no decision to bring before the Lord. And so, here we have David asking for the ephod, which was, in effect, inquiring before the Lord. And then in verse 7, I'll make sure I'm in the right place here. Then David said to Abiathar the priest, we read this, please bring the ephod here to me. Okay, and then if we skip on down to verse 9, it says, so David went, he and 600 men who were with him, and came to the brook Besor, where those stayed who were left behind. They had found an Egyptian slave who was too weak to make it, and then we go on to verse 10 here. It says, I'll make sure here. And then verse 10 says, but David pursued, he and 400 men, for 200 stayed behind, who were so weary that they could not cross the brook Besor. So they had 200 men that could not stay with them. They were just too tired, which is just an interesting part of this story. And then if you skip on down, and we're running out of time, but verses 16 through 20 says, so when he had brought him down there, there they were spread all over the land, eating and drinking and dancing because of all the great spoil which they had taken from the land and of the Philistines and from the land of Judah. And David attacked them from twilight until the evening of the next day. Not a man of them escaped except for 400 young men who rode on camels and fled. So David recovered all of the Amalekites had carried away, and David rescued his two wives. And nothing of theirs was lacking, either small or great, sons or daughters, spoil, or anything which he had taken from them. David recovered all. Then David took all the flocks and herds which they had driven before those other livestock and said, "This is David's spoil." Kind of interesting turn of events here. You've got young and old with them. Of course, we have some that were so tired they were left behind. He comes upon these people and completely, you know, drives them all out except those that were mentioned on camels, and so they take off. What's interesting to me, and I came across this, and I know I've read it, but was surprised. But were all of David's men considered God-fearing men that were with him? All of the men that were, I guess maybe a better way to answer that is, or ask that is, were his men dedicated to God? Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Verse 22 says, "Then all of the wicked and worthless men of those who went with David answered and said," you know, "because they did not go with us, we will not give them any of the spoil that we have recovered, except of every man's wife and children, that they may lead them away and depart." Wicked and worthless men, you know, and I don't know if there's anything special there to bring out, but interesting.
It's kind of like, there's a, and I can't think of the name I'm trying to think of, but there's certain people from one country will go to another country to join a battle just because they like to fight.
Yeah.
It kind of sounds like David's not king yet.
Right.
But he's strong.
I want to get involved in this.
Let's just follow him. This looks exciting.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he calls them brethren. And he says, like verse 23.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to read. Can you read 23 through 25? That was in the next passage just to read.
But David said, "My brethren, you shall not do so with what the Lord has given us, who has preserved us and delivered into our hand the truth that came against us. For who will heed you in this matter? But as his part is who goes down to the battle, so shall his part be who stays by the supplies. They shall share alike." So it was from that day forward he made a statute and an ordinance for Israel to this day.
Okay. So interesting here. He's saying, "Hey, we can't, you know, you the word brethren there, we can't be doing this." One more thing there. I've got verse 7. Let me go back. "Then David said to Abiathar, the priest of Abimelech's son, 'Please bring the ephod here to me.' And Abiathar brought the ephod to David." David approached, you know, Abiathar the priest rather than inquire of the Lord, which is interesting. He didn't inquire of the Lord at the tabernacle. Where was the tabernacle at this time? And I'm just looking for a generic, but okay. And whose territory would that have been? Who would have been running that?
Saul.
Yeah. So reading of, he was in Saul's territory. So David, in effect, was using what was likely, I guess, the only tabernacle related possession that was at his disposal. I mean, I guess. Again, I'm not sure that was right, but we know that, or I mention that because there in verse 25, does anyone here find it odd that David at this point in time made a statue and an ordinance at this point in his life? I think it's interesting. So it was from that day forward that he made it a statue and an ordinance for Israel. I'm going to ring the buzzer here. We're a minute late. But was that an acceptable thing to make this statue?
Well, it's possible that, you know, here this is David leading this group of people. He's apparently in charge of this Philistine city that's been given to him. You know, maybe he's allowed to make rules there, and then when he becomes king of Israel, it's just a rule that he brings along with him.
Yeah. I ask because I don't know. Yeah.
I mean, you know, he's always a commander.
Sure.
Of armies. You know, even when he's king, he's constantly fighting. Mm-hmm. And this is a policy that he has about fighting.
So okay. We know that God, you know, David's chosen by God, just like Samuel and other people were. We know that God gave David a lot of leeway.
A lot.
Things he did, much more than Saul.
He did.
And even though Saul was chosen by God to be the first king, You know, right. He just wasn't favored by God when he made him.
Yeah. Wasn't mad at God. Okay, we'll take a quick break. Thank you.